Hello, I'm Chana Silberstein. I'm chair of the Ithaca Area United Jewish Community. And it's a great honor to welcome all of you here today for our event, Commemorating the Holocaust, Affirming Community. On behalf of the board of the IAUJC, welcome. Welcome Cornell President David Skorton. Welcome Ms. Elizabeth Dobromsky of the Jewish Federations of North America. Welcome survivors of the Holocaust and your families. Welcome rescuers and liberators and your families. Welcome generous sponsors of this event. Welcome presenters and participating choir members. And welcome all members of our greater Ithaca community for joining us today. You will find in the program brief biographies of all our presenters, the words to the songs we will be singing, and a list of further resources for studying about the Holocaust. I want to frame today's events with a selection from an ancient Jewish text called the Midrash. The genesis of the Jewish people begins with the story of the biblical Abraham. In a generation of great military power and human invention and bustling trade, in a generation of idolatry and child sacrifice and selfishness, greed, and depravity, Abraham embarked on his path of spiritual exploration, attempting to make sense of the contradictions in his world. The Midrash describes this search with a parable. It says Abraham was like a traveler wandering from place to place who suddenly sighted a palace in flames. He said to himself in wonder, in horror, in disbelief, "Can it be that this palace has no owner?" Germany of the 20th century was the center of culture and scientific advancement, and the Jews were well assimilated and integrated into that world. Frederick Grunfeld writes that had the end not been so horrible, we would now hail the decades before the Nazi rise to power as a golden age second only to the Italian Renaissance. This is the enigma of the Holocaust. There is a palace, a beautiful palace. It did not arise from nothingness. It speaks to intelligence, to planning, to aesthetics, to human progress and development. And yet, the palace is in flames. There is cruelty and indifference, chaos and destruction, and it is allowed to go unchecked. Can it be that the palace has no owner? George Santayana famously says that those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it. Long before that, Moses, in his final address to the people of Israel, told them, "Zichor yimot olam, binu shenot dar vador, she'alavicha v'yagetcha, zikeinecha v'yomru lach." Remember the days of old. Understand the years of each generation. Ask your father, and he will tell you. Your elders, and they will recount it to you. The past has its lessons, and our parents and grandparents have much to teach us. But we will only know these lessons if we ask them for their story, if we are prepared to listen and to reflect. Thank you, all of you, for coming here today to hear the story of those who witnessed the Holocaust. Thank you for being willing to remember it, to understand it, to honor it, to learn from it, and for carrying the responsibility to share this story in turn. We will now hear from Rabbi Lau, former chief rabbi of Israel and youngest survivor of Buchenwald, who will tell us what it means to be a survivor. We will hear from local resident Professor Leo Grunfeld, eyewitness to Kristallnacht, before anyone could imagine that this was the beginning of the end. We will hear Mrs. Ruth Windmuller, who journeyed to America on the St. Louis, only to find that the world had closed its doors to the plight of the Jews. And we'll hear Professor Roald Hoffman tell what it was like to be a hidden child during the war, as well as his experience of being reunited with his courageous rescuers.
1944, the Jews of Petrikov were rounded up and taken to the train station for transport to Buchenwald. The Nazis separated the men from the women and children. Drawing on her natural instincts, a Jewish mother realized that the men would have a better chance of survival and engaged in her final act of love.
אני הייתי בהלם, ואת זוכר שצעק את זה. מה, מה לצ'גו? אמא, למה? למה את זרקת? היא רק נופפה עם היד, זה היה לפנוף אחרון. לפרידה יותר לא ראינו אותה בחיים.
The young Lau was the youngest survivor of Buchenwald. Years later, as the chief rabbi of Israel, he traveled widely around the world to discuss issues of Jewish concern.
עד קוד שהביע את משאלתו לפגוש אותי, לארח אותי באולם העירייה. באתי לשם, והוא מקדם את פניי בחיבוק גדול, הוא אומר לי, you know, I'm also a survivor. גם אני ניצול שואה. לא היה לי נעים להגיד לאיש, שזה נשמע לי מוזר, מביך אפילו, כי אני למדתי שהוא יליד ניו יורק. הוא מספר, הייתי במשלחת ראשי ערים מכל העולם, לליקור בברלין, וראינו את הגלובוס המפורסם שעמד על קנו בחדר, במשרד של היטלר, ורואים שהמון מספרים בטוש שחור מופיעים עליו. היטלר ציווה את הצוות שלו שיכתבו לו על כל ארץ בגלובוס מספר היהודים ב-1-9-39. אלבניה הייתה בספרה אחד, יהודי אחד, גם עליו הוא לא ויתר. ארצות הברית של אמריקה, 6 מיליון. I am one of them. אני אחד מהם, Ed Koch, from Bronx, New York. I was on his target. אני הייתי על המטרה שלו. I was his destination, אני הייתי ביעד שלו. אם לא היינו עוצרים, הוא אומר, the Nazi beast, את החיה הנאצי, אני לא הייתי מדבר איתך היום, אני לא הייתי חי. So I'm also a survivor. אמרתי לו, thank you for the lesson you taught me. כל יהודי, באשר הוא, הוא ניצול שואה.
By the time I got to Nieburstrasse in 1935, all my friends were Jewish. And I was thrown out of public school. My mother was called by the principal. And he told my mother that there was no place for me. My father's brother had left for Palestine. And there were sort of delayed plans and vague fantasies about someday going, because Germany was much too good for us to leave, you see. I say that with some bitterness. Now that was an exclusive private Jewish school. And I went there until Kristallnacht in 1938, when that school was burned down. I think that of all the things that I've seen in my life, I was in the army, I saw in Shanghai, I saw a lot of poverty, I saw people dying, I saw a lot of things. That day, the 10th of November, considering my age also, I was 11 years old. The single day with the largest impact on my life, although the day itself, as I remember, it didn't really traumatize me. I mean, I didn't get hysterical, but I was curious. and I was driven by curiosity, not by fear. In the morning, I had to take the streetcar to go to the Theater Hochschule, and I came out, and at the streetcar station, there was a candy store. And the windows of that store were smashed in. In Germany, when something like this happens, there is usually police or older people who will, you know, the older people used to tell us how to cross the street. There was no one saying anything, and these kids were robbing the store blind. I didn't make anything of it. I just thought that was very peculiar. Maybe, you know, they tried to rob the store, or maybe it was an anti-Semitic act, but I didn't know that this was the magnitude of it, that the whole city was actually in flames. I took the streetcar and I went to school. And I arrived at the streetcar station at the school, and one of the teachers told us that the school was on fire and that we should go home. And then I looked and I saw the smoke. And again, what was noteworthy was that the fire brigade was there, but they didn't use the hoses. I went downstairs. I don't know whether my mother let me go, whether I just went. I would not have let my children go out, but I went. I went to the synagogue first, and it was in flames. Again, I saw police. They didn't do anything. And I saw Torah scrolls unrolled in the streets and people walking on them. I saw three Jews being tied together with tefillin, and the Nazis saying, "Dance, Jews," and saying to them, "So where is your God?" And I actually remember looking up, hoping that God will answer. I don't know what got into me. I had a friend who went with me to the Hochschule. Was a little bit older than I am, and he's told me that we should go inside and rescue one of those Torah scrolls. And we did. Well, all the schools were burned, all the synagogues were burned. I remember telling my mother that we must leave, and that if my father and she cannot decide to leave, that I'm going to leave by myself, and that I had enrolled to be taken to Denmark to go on Hochschule, and that there was nothing they could do about it.
I'm Ruth Windmuller, one of the survivors. I was born in a town at the foot of the Harz Mountains in Germany into a very assimilated German-Jewish family. My father was born in the town where we lived. His father was well established. He had opened a modest-sized department store, which my father inherited together with his cousin. And judging by the way we lived, it must have been fairly successful. I was a very immature 11, 14-year-old. I really had no interest in what was going on in the world or in our town. I liked to play, ride my bike, go swimming, whatever children do. My parents were very protective. Problems were not discussed over the dinner table, so I was really not had no idea about politics or anything. The first thing I was aware of when Hitler came to power was the book burning. Books of Jewish authors and communist authors and various undesirables were burned, and apparently this was, I gathered from my parents, a very bad thing. Later on, more restrictions came. Lawyers could not practice anymore. Doctors were supposed to have only Jewish patients. Music was banned, written by Jewish composers. And later on, I could not go to the swimming pool anymore, and I like to swim. My parents were not able to go to the theater anymore or the movies. And eventually, German artists got together and formed a, not a society, but some kind of a organization where they would travel around Germany and perform for Jewish audiences. In our city, it took place at the synagogue because the theater was not open to us. Other restrictions came. You could not have any young household help anymore. We used to have a live-in maid. We had to let her go. She was a young, they were young girls from the farms, and we could only hire mature women of 45 or older. Things became more tight all the time, but my father was convinced it would blow over. Nobody would put up with this crazy man, Hitler. And besides, he had fought for Germany in World War I, so he was safe. Nothing would happen to him. Well, I think he, so to speak, woke up when in October of 1938, a young family who lived in our apartment building disappeared. We were told by some of our friends and neighbors they had arrested all the people who had been born in Poland and had settled in Germany. They put them on trains, took them over the German border into Poland, and that was that. We received a postcard from this young couple who had a baby that they were now in Poland, but nothing else. Well, then there was a knock on the door on the 9th of November. And we were told, my parents were told, to get dressed. This was at night, to get dressed and come with them. The SS people were taking them to a collection point in town. And we realized that all the Jews in the city had been assembled there. In the morning, they let the children and the women go, but kept the men, and we found out a day or two later that the men had been taken to concentration camps. That included my father and my oldest brother, who was living at home because he worked in my father's store. When we came home, and my mother and I came home, the apartment was pretty much destroyed with broken glass and crystal, and we were told from neighbors that also the synagogue had been burned in town. After about 4 weeks or so, my father and many of the other people were released from the camp, and they had signed a statement that they would leave Germany within 3 or 6 months. Well, by that time, where to go? There was not much open. Not many countries were willing to admit Jews. There was China. I heard my parents discuss Madagascar. I had no idea where it was. To me, it seemed like a place, the bush. But my father found that you could purchase a visa at the Cuban embassy in Berlin. So for $500 a piece, and I have no idea where he got dollars from, or whether they took marks and what that would be worth, but $500 in 1930 was no chicken feed. We were also able to get passage on a German luxury liner from the Hapag America line, which routinely went from Hamburg to America and South America. My father decided to book cabin class because we could not take any money out of Germany. We each were allowed 10 marks to take out of Germany. 10 marks, I have no idea whether it would be even worth $10. It was a wonderful trip to Cuba, luxurious. The captain had instructed the crew that we were paying guests and should be treated accordingly. This was a German crew, and they honored that. But on arrival in Havana, we found, even though all the preparations had been made, luggage on top, officials coming on board to check our credentials, that they would not let us dock or land. There was a lot of upheaval on board ship, but a committee was formed to quiet us and keep us informed that there would be negotiations between the Cubans and the American Joint Distribution Committee, and things would be worked out. Well, after 5 or 7 days, it turned out the captain was asked to leave the harbor, of the outer harbor of Havana, and he sailed slowly towards the American shores. We could see Miami in the distance, and the Coast Guard surrounding us to make sure nobody jumped ship to swim ashore. After a few other days, maybe 4 days or so, the Hamburg America line told the captain he would have to turn around and come back because the ship was scheduled for another trip. So he had no choice but turned around and sailed towards Europe. He kept the committee and then the passengers informed of the negotiations and assured them negotiations were still going on, and at that point with organizations in Europe. He also, in private, assured the committee, who consisted of about 6 or 8 lawyers, passengers, that he would not return the ship to Germany. He would scuttle the ship on the British coast. Now, that took courage. If he had been forced to do that, that would have been the end of his career. Fortunately, as we approached Europe, the European Joint Distribution Committee with other Jewish committees had arranged to distribute these 935 passengers between England, Holland, Belgium, and France. My mother decided that we should go to France because she knew a little bit of French. As a young girl, she had been sent to Montreux to a finishing school. So we went to France. So, by the way, it happened was my future husband, John Windmuller, and his parents, who were also in the St. Louis, but I didn't know him then, had also chosen to go to France, and that's where I met John. In France, we were separated from our parents. The parents were sent to Le Mans, a smaller town south of Paris, and we were supported completely by the Joint Distribution Committee. The children were sent to refugee homes, which the OSE, an old white Russian organization who had moved from St. Petersburg to Berlin and then from Berlin to Paris, took care of orphans, or in this case, in 1939, they took care of refugee children, mainly who had come to France on kinder transports. Their parents had sent them to France to be safe. Well, these children, if they survived at all, never saw their parents again. In 1940, our home was north of Paris, and we could hear shooting, bombs falling, maybe, I don't know how many miles away, but we could definitely hear it. And the directors of the home decided we would join all the people on the highways to go south in France to what turned out to be free France, Vichy France, where we also ended up in OSE homes. The OSE arranged all that. And luckily, in 1942, our quota number, our visa, came through. And my husband and his family had just left a few months earlier. And we were able to come to the United States. And we were also partially supported when we first arrived in New York by Jewish organizations.
So I was born in Poland in 1937. When my mother was born, it was Austria-Hungary. When I was born, it was Poland. After World War II, it became the Soviet Union, and now is the Ukraine, the place where we were born, not too far from the town of Lemberg, Lviv. For us, the war broke out in 1939 first, the Soviets occupied our part of Poland as they split Poland with the Germans. It was not a bad time for Jews. It was not a good time for the Ukrainians during those 2 years of Soviet occupation. In 1941, the Germans invaded the Soviet Union and that part, and were in that part where we were within about a week. So for us, the war lasted from the end of June of 41 till June 44, 3 years. I was at this time 4 years old. We were in the end the largest family group that survived out of about a population of around 4,000 in the town, difficult to tell because refugees came in during the period 39 to 41. About 200 survived, among them three children, and I was one of those three. We survived in three different ways, all of the ways having to do with not getting into a concentration camp or in one of the shipments to the concentration camps, the result of the so-called actions. We survived, two of us, one grandparent and one uncle of mine, in a bunker in town, a hidden hiding place under a house, one in a forest, though he later came into hiding, in a partisan group, and four and then five of us in hidden out toward the end of the war, but first in a labor camp. The story of the labor camps is one of the quiet stories of the war. My grandfather was killed in a pogrom in the first week of the war that was organized by SS Einsatzgruppe C and the Viking Division, helped by the local Ukrainian population. And so my uncle crawled out from among the dead at the castle where this pogrom was held, and where about 2,000 people were killed. We were in a labor camp, and then were hidden out the last 15 months of the war, four of us, and then five eventually, by a Ukrainian school teacher in a small village around 40 kilometers from Zlochev, the town where I was born. This was the only brick house in the village, the school. The school teacher was educated. He was actually the spokesman for the village to the Germans. He had studied at the University of Prague, and the village was very small, maybe 50 houses, maybe 200 people at most. In that schoolhouse, in the attic, we were hidden, and the first slide here shows actually that attic. It has been rebuilt somewhat. The ceiling was not as high. As I'll tell you in just a moment, I went back there in 2006 with my sister and my son, and this is the attic. You can see the holes, it's not insulated. We survived one winter there. Ukrainian winters are just about the same as Ithaca winters were. The second winter, we couldn't stay there. We moved to a storage room on the first floor where there were no windows. There was a window in front. That window that you see in front there was actually boarded up so that no one in the village, it was onto the street, so that no one in the village would see. The next slide shows the window toward the rear, which had wooden slats toward it. This was a schoolhouse, and children were playing out there, and I could watch those children playing. Among the children who was playing there were several Jewish boys who were being hidden in the monastery of the Greek Catholic Church that was at the end of the road under false identities. One of them subsequently became the foreign minister of Poland, Adam Daniel Rotfeld. But I could watch those children playing through that window. Occasionally we had a light at night, but it was difficult. We stayed there, as I said, about 8 months in that attic. We were freed by the Red Army in June 44. The war in Europe was not over for still another year, but that was the end of the war for us. We left that part of Poland, eventually came to the United States in 1949 when I was 11 and a half, after some wanderings through the rest of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, and Germany. And in 1954, my uncle Sam, who was at that time a dentist in Pittsburgh, into his office, there walked in a person from that village. And through that person, we got in touch with a family who had hidden us out. Their name was Mikola and Maria Duke. We established contact in 1954, and we've been in contact with the family ever since. The couple who hid us out are no longer alive. Three of their children, one just died, are alive, and their children. And we saw them for the first time in 2006, when after 62 years, I had tried to go back there during Soviet times, but it was not allowed. But in 2006, I went back, and the next slide shows Igor Duke, the son of the man who hid us, and he's pointing to something in that attic, which you saw in the previous slide. Igor is exactly the same age as I am, and I had a memory of playing with him for a day or two. But we never went out of that house during the 15 months that we were there. And so I asked him, I have this memory, and he said, of course we played. But it was after the war. You came back for 2 days to pick up something that was in the attic. And we actually did play, and he remembered that. I remember exactly what we did, but I didn't. We established contact, we've kept contact. In the early days, we sent packages to the family, which had to be sent through the Soviet embassy, certain ordered packages. You paid a duty of 200%, but the packages got there. They involved the usual things. Eventually, they could ask for something. And the next slide, which looks mysterious, of a woman showing off a table runner, has something to do with that and something to do with the connections that one has with people. This is Lyuba Duke, who is the wife of Igor. So it was her father and mother-in-law who hid us out. With a letter we got from the Ukraine by a roundabout way, said, send us some colored thread. So what is the colored thread for? We didn't understand this. We didn't understand until a few years later. The colored thread was needed because a traditional Ukrainian craft is embroidery. And so what was the Russian thread that they had ran. It's as simple as that. And so they wanted some good American thread. So what you see is a runner hand-woven from Ukrainian linen by Lyuba Duke and embroidered with good American thread. And that is one story that continues to this day.
Thank you for sharing your stories. There are a number of Jewish memorial prayers that are traditionally said for those that are no longer with us. And these prayers share a theme. These prayers recognize the eternity of the soul and the spirit, even as bodies die and decay. They recognize that whereas those who are no longer with us cannot act in their own behalf, we can serve as their hands and feet, as their mouths and hearts, performing the acts of goodness and kindness that they are no longer here to do on their own. And they recognize that so long as those who are gone are able to inspire a better world, they continue to have a presence among us. By remembering them and by resolving to do good because of them, we give them eternal life. I would like to acknowledge all of the Holocaust survivors present, those living in pre-war Europe who escaped with their lives, as well as their spouses, children, and grandchildren, and other family members who are accompanying them here today. Those who wish to remain seated can remain seated. Those who wish to rise, please stand and be recognized. And those who wish to come to the front of the auditorium, you or your family members, we would be very honored to have you come to the front. Rabbi Scott Glass, okay, let's give people a moment to come here. Okay, thank you so much. All right. Okay, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. Rabbi Scott Glass of Temple Beth El will now recite a memorial prayer for those who were killed during the Holocaust, and for the survivors who are no longer with us. He will be followed by Cantor Abby Lyons of Congregation Tikkun V'Or, who will sing Psalm 23.
In solidarity with those who have survived, and in tribute to those who perished, I ask those who are able to rise at your seats for this prayer of remembrance. El Malay Rachamim, Shochein Bamromim, Hametzei Menuchana Chonatachat Kanfei Ashchina. Bemalot kidoshim utaurim kizohar harakia mazhirim lenishmot kol acheinu b'nei Yisrael shenitbechu v'ashoah anashim nashim v'taf shenechniku v'shenisrefu v'shenahergu shemasru et nafsham al kiddush Hashem בגן עדן תמנוחתם, אנא בעל הרחמים, הסתירים בסתר כנפיך לעולמים, וצרור בצרור החיים את נשמותיהם, אדוני ונחלתם, וינוחו ושלום על משכבותיהם, ונאמר אמן. Exalted, compassionate God, grant infinite rest in your sheltering presence among the holy and pure to the souls of our brethren who perished in the Shoah, men, women, and children who were slaughtered and suffocated and burned to ashes. May their memory endure and inspire deeds of charity and goodness in our lives. May their souls thus be bound up in the bond of everlasting life. May they rest in peace, and let us say, Amen. The assemblage may be seated.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leadeth me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
Psychologist Chaim Ginot writes this in his book, Teacher and Child. I am a survivor of a concentration camp. My eyes saw what no man should witness: gas chambers built by learned engineers, children poisoned by educated physicians, infants killed by trained nurses, women and babies shot and burned by high school and college graduates. So I am suspicious of education. My request is, help your students become human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, educated Eichmanns. Reading, writing, and arithmetic are important only if they serve to make our children more humane. We are honored to have with us President David Skorton of Cornell, who through leadership and example has promoted the values of respect and caring, of compassion and tolerance on this campus and throughout the Ithaca community. Welcome, President Skorton.
In the Garden of Stones, sculptor Andy Goldsworthy has given us emblems of permanence and change, of harsh adversity and irrepressible life. The granite boulders, weighing 4 to 8 tons each, were formed by fire thousands of years ago, deep in the earth. Over centuries, the upheaval of the earth's crust brought them to the surface, and the grinding process of glaciers transported them. A Connecticut stone worker cored 3 of these boulders with 4,000-degree blowtorch, and they were brought by truck to Ithaca. Now they rest in the plantations, in the Garden of Stones. Despite the forces on them, despite the passage of time, still immutably themselves, part of this natural world. 5.5 years ago in a moving ceremony, Holocaust survivors and others planted dwarf chestnut oaks in the soil-filled cores of these boulders. Today, those trees are flourishing, symbols of life in the very center of adversity. The dwarf chestnut oak grows only about 10 feet tall, but it is tough and resilient, often surviving for hundreds of years. As the trees send their branches and leaves upward, their roots grow downward through the hollowed boulders, fusing to the rock along their way to the soil beneath. As Andy Goldsworthy has said, the stones are not mere containers. The partnership between tree and stone will be stronger for the tree having grown from the stone. Through the symbolism of the Garden of Stones, today we honor the survivors of the Holocaust and of all the ways that they have contributed to bettering our world. America has been fortunate to receive many of them. They became productive and often outstanding members of our society. At least one among us earned a Nobel Prize for his brilliant insights. Dr. Hoffman, thank you for sharing your moving story. My father was born just a few hundred kilometers from where you were and came to the U.S. 20 years before. The brutal history of the Holocaust cannot be changed, of course, but we can learn from it. The hope of a saner world, one where such horrors will not be allowed to take place, does lie in education, by which I mean more than simply the schooling of the young. We must encourage throughout our society, among people of all ages, both the learning of history and facts and ideas, and the grounding of that knowledge in cultural understanding, compassion, and a sense of justice. We need a society that is informed, engaged, but also compassionate and vigilant. As we work toward that ideal, hope is all around us. I see it in the diversity of people here with us today. Many of us are Jewish, but many others of different faiths are here in solidarity. For some, the Holocaust is an ineradicable memory, but many others are so young that it must seem, even today, remote. But they are here too, with respect and concern. Some of you are teachers who have brought your students. Thank you for seizing this opportunity to make the past more meaningful. It is, of course, in the young that we see hope embodied. Many young people were involved in planning and participating in today's program, including the Ithaca College Park Scholars, high school student Hannah Felchu, who will be speaking soon, and the chorale of the Ithaca Children's Choir, whose very beautiful voices I hope you have heard before and you will hear momentarily. These young people represent not only hope, but healing and the prospect of a more just and compassionate future built on a shared understanding of the past. In the Garden of Stones last spring, the fresh green of new life could be seen rising out of the aged boulders. And even in the depths of winter, under the bark, the wood will remain green, reminding us that life is tenacious, and the bare trees, well, they are only resting. The granite boulders may represent whatever is hard, unyielding, harsh, but they are also symbols of integrity and strength. In the fusing of root and rock, in the fierce sun-seeking growth of the tree, we see hope, and it is very much alive.
Let us return now to the story with which we began. Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks describes it this way. Abraham sees a palace. He sees a world that has order. Therefore, it has an architect, a creator. But the palace is in flames, which means that the world is full of disorder, full of evil, violence, and injustice. Now, nobody builds a building and goes away and deserts it. Therefore, if there is a fire, there must be someone there to put it out. The building must have an owner. And that is the question that gives Abraham no peace. Can God have created this world only to abandon it? Can it be that the world has no one in charge? There are two, and only two logical possibilities. The first is that this is a world that's governed by blind forces, by genetic mutation and natural selection. The strong and the well-adapted survive. The weak and the maladapted die. There is no justice because there is no judge. We can ask how, but we can never ask why. Because there is no palace. There are only flames. That is logical possibility number one. Or number two, the opposite. God exists. Everything that happens, happens because he wills it. All injustice is an illusion. All evil is good in disguise. There are no flames. There is only the palace. But the faith of Abraham begins with the refusal to accept either answer. Because suppose both exist. Suppose there is both God and evil. Suppose there is both a palace and flames. Then there is a contradiction. You cannot resolve the problem by logic or by philosophy or by theology. You can only solve it by action, by making the world better than it is, by acting to put out the flames. Let me tell you how the Midrash concludes. Abraham says, "Is there an owner to the palace?" And God replies, "I am the owner of the palace." That's all he says. Abraham says to God, "Ribono shel olam, Master of the universe, your world is on fire. Where are you?" And God replies with the first words he said to Adam and Eve as they were about to leave the garden. Ayeka, where are you? Abraham says, "God, why did you abandon the world?" And God says to Abraham, "Why did you abandon me?" And there, then, begins that dialogue between heaven and earth that has not ceased in 4,000 years. The dialogue in which God and man find each other, whose resolution is not an answer, a solution whose resolution is action. Because God says to man, "Only you can put out the flames, and I will show you how." We now call upon Ms. Hannah Felcher, 11th grader at the Lehman Alternative Community School, who will speak about why the Holocaust is relevant and how we can continue to be ever vigilant. Hannah.
Thank you, Dr. Silberstein. I'm honored to be able to speak to you all today. The suffering of Holocaust survivors often affect their children. The daughter of a Holocaust survivor is in our audience today. She vividly remembers her mother's story. During the 1930s, her mother was terrorized at school. A Christian girl came to her aid, courageously refusing to stand idly by. I interviewed that Christian girl, who is now an 87-year-old woman still living in Hamburg, Germany, her home during the Nazi reign. I will call her Greta. Greta precisely recalled the details of her life as a young girl. She spoke of the period when she attended high school, was trained as a medical technician, the progression of her family's suffering during the bombing of Hamburg, and how this event forced them to move out of their house and find a new place to live. She spoke of her mother's death, at which point the teenage Greta became a homemaker, as well as her father's secretary. The story Greta told me was harrowing, but as you've heard from our speakers today, it cannot equal the tragedy of those who had the misfortune of being Jews in Germany during this time. What did Greta tell me as to the suffering of the Jews? She said very little. Only two memories of Jewish persecution stayed with Greta, events that are haunting in retrospect. Greta told me that she saw the Jews of her town marched along the side of the road, carrying their possessions in small wooden carts. When she inquired as to where these people were traveling, she was told that they were, quote, leaving the country. She requested no more specifics. Greta also said, quote, there was only one Jewish girl in my class, and I don't know what happened to her, because one day, she was gone. What is clear from Greta's interview is that Greta's behavior was completely and utterly human. Greta defended a friend when she was bullied, but beyond this action, she was focused on the details of her own life. She didn't allow her reality to include ominous acts of anti-Semitism. And she told me that it wasn't discussed around her father's dinner table. When I finished the interview process, I wondered what I had learned from speaking to Greta, a person who had an inner humanity, in a moment, at least, of uncommon courage. Greta and thousands of people like her teach future generations a vital imperative. Remain vigilant and aware of seemingly harmless wrongs, and never forget that great wrongs can grow from small acts of inhumanity. I have learned that injustice can progress in small, quiet steps, and that actions we have long forgotten can impact generations far into the future. I have learned that it is not insurmountable acts of bravery that constitute heroism. Heroism is striving to never forget the suffering of others, even when you are faced with your own. I have also learned that the Nazis' hatred of the Jews was only one of their core values. An equally vicious belief was that difference was intolerable and had to be eradicated. Given the recent rash of suicides by gay teens and racial tensions that exist within our own society, I feel privileged to live in a community where people work to tolerate and value difference. And I feel privileged to attend a school based on the same principle. Finally, I have learned that perhaps one maxim can save us. Take action. Take action when bigotry and corruption run rampant through our political and social arenas. Take action when students stand to forget the horrors that occurred before their time. Take action so that we can truly say, never again. Thank you.
would please join us as a pledge that we can take action together to bring a more peaceful world. If you feel comfortable. The words are on page 2 of your program.
Thank you, Voices Choir. Zichor Yimot Olam, remember, understand, ask. If we have heard the stories that were told today, then we will resolve never to be passive in the face of oppression, never to see evil and simply look away. We invite you to visit the Garden of Stones, and should you choose to explore it right after this event, there's a member of the plantation staff there who awaits your visit. Middle school, high school, and college students and their teachers, leaders, and parents are invited to gather today from 3:30 to 6 p.m. at the Cornell University Multicultural Dining Hall. Some of you know it as the Kosher Dining Hall, at 104 West Avenue, to discuss what you experienced at this event and to exchange ideas for taking action regarding current concerns. I invite you all to join us now for a reception in the atrium of the Vet Education Center. As soon as we're done, follow the signs and the ushers down the hall, and then to your right. I'd like to give a special thank you to Vali Kovari and to Marjorie Hoffman, who coordinated this event today. Okay, and then I'd like to conclude with a round of applause for all our presenters, all the participants that made this commemoration possible. Thank you all for being with here and joining us and making this such a special event.